sounds of the hound that's howling under your bed. He's there growling, same time you're cowering. That's Run the Jewels. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jays Talk Plus. Terrific outing for the hound. Yesterday, Chris Bassitt gets back on the right foot after a couple of rough ones. Two earned over seven, took a no-hitter into the sixth before Jackson Holliday broke it up with a home run. Pretty good game, all things considered, for Chris Bassitt and for the Blue Jays. Bassitt went into the eighth, got into some trouble. Yennis Cabrera helped him get out of it with only one of three bequeathed runners scoring. And then, yeah, on the offensive side, Jays get a couple stolen bases. They get a big home run from Alejandro Kirk. A five-run sixth inning. All the action coming with two outs. It included a big hit from Addison Barger going system of a down and away to take a double the other way and score a couple runs. Fun game. Fun game all around. A couple minor updates before we get to the guests today. The White Sox beat the Royals yesterday, so the longest losing streak in American League history is over, and the MLB record losing streak, which they were two games away from, remains safe for at least 23 more games. Framber Valdez also almost tossed his second no-hitter in as many seasons last night, but Corey Seager homered with two outs in the ninth. It is the second time Corey Seager has broken up a no-hitter with two outs in the ninth. What a jerk. Corey Seager does not like history. A couple rainouts around the Jays minor league system yesterday, so no AAA action, no Joey Votto action, things like that. We did get two AAA updates, though. Jake Bloss will start on Saturday, so we'll get the first look at the primary chip in the Yusei Kikuchi trade. And Aaron Sanchez was released. He ended up posting a 7.92 ERA over 61 and a third innings for the Bisons, but as the Jays introduce new draftees and all the prospects they picked up from the trade deadline, you can only have 165 guys under minor league contract. So some guys had to go. Aaron Sanchez, Bo Sulser, and then a few lower-level minor league guys who just hadn't clicked in their auditions being let go. Series continues tonight, 7:07, Bowden Francis against Trevor Rogers. And around 2:15, Mark Shapiro will speak to Blue Jays media down at Rogers Center. Let's see how Keegan Mathison of MLB.com, of BlueJays.com, is feeling about all that. Keegan, how we doing, buddy?
I'm doing well, Blake. How we doing today?
Pretty good, man. We'll get to the Shapiro stuff in a little bit. Did want to talk about the game that was. The games are still happening. There are about 50 of them left still. Pretty good one overall. When talking to the Jays after the game, did they think Kimbrel hit Vlad on purpose? Was that the issue there when that happened?
Yeah, John Schneider called that a heat of the moment thing. He was quick out of the dugout. He had some words for Kimbrel. I think the Sportsnet broadcast caught it really well. You don't need to be a great lip reader to know what he said. And that is that's certainly Schneid's right there. And the Blue Jays did not like that. Certainly coming from Kimbrel as well, who they have a history with. So they didn't like it. There's a history going back there with the Orioles. If the Blue Jays were good, Blue Jays Orioles, I think, is a really great rivalry. It's missing a piece right now, but there's real potential for these two teams to hate each other. I think Brandon Hyde and John Schneider would be a great rival manager, if that's even a thing. But it's there. The powder's there if the Blue Jays are ever good enough to make this a rivalry.
Well, that's the issue, right, is you've got to be on roughly the same level. Like, Raptors fans do not like Celtics fans and don't like the Celtics, but the Raptors have never done much to the Celtics. So it's hard to call it a rivalry, even like Yankees Red Sox, one of the most storied rivalries, until like we got Jimmy Fallon and fever pitch and things like that. It was a big brother little brother rivalry. It was like, okay, I'm your rival, I don't care about you, get away from me. So that's where the Jays would need to get back to. In terms of positive things that happened in that game, how tempted are you night to night to just write the Dalton Varsho story a bunch of different ways over the course of the season?
In a season where not much else is happening, pretty damn tempting, Blake, I tell you. It's amazing to watch him every single night, because the highlights are one thing, but watching how he closes on balls, watching the work that he puts into this, I'm so impressed with Dalton Varsho defensively. And I think I need to do a better job of realizing right now, in the moment, that watching Dalton Varsho play defense might be something that I'm talking about 20 years from now. Like, I really think it's that special. And to go into the Gold Glove, Platinum Glove conversations, that's as imperfect an award as there is that exists right now. I don't really judge guys on those too much. But Varsho is obviously deserving of these. And what interests me most about Varsho, Blake, is how his teammates and his manager talk about him. Now, Chris Bassett said last night, if he doesn't get the platinum glove, get rid of it. It doesn't matter anymore. John Schneider says every day that he is the best defensive outfielder in baseball. He says best outfielder in baseball. People don't act on good faith. We all know he means defensive outfielder. I know what he hits. Whatever. It's defense. And Dalton Varsho was just magnificent. And the way his teammates talk about him is so special, because one of my favorite things in this job is getting a teammate talking about someone they play with in such a passionate way like that. It's really refreshing. And I think it's a really beautiful thing when you get teammates talking about their teammates with such a level of respect and such a level of admiration. And that's what you hear for Varsho to a man. Every single guy in that clubhouse is amazed with what he does. And they know how hard it is. They know how hard it must be to run into a wall full speed and take that beating. It's there's some bravery involved in all of this as well. It's just incredible. I like you said, Blake, it's tempting every night. I got to pick my spots, but those spots are probably coming up. He demands it.
He does. And like you said, some of the quotes coming out last night, you know, Chris Bassett saying, never going to take him and what he's doing for granted. John Schneider saying they're spoiled to have that behind them. And if you're a Blue Jays pitcher, like, there's a reason Chris Bassett goes on Twitter and then after every game where Varsho does something is championing this, because the way we can measure these things quantitatively, obviously we can see it. The highlights are the highlights. Dalton Varsho has saved the Blue Jays pitching staff an estimated 50 runs over the last 2 years. Jeez. The next highest outfielder is at 25. So we're talking double over two seasons. You know who the next highest outfielder is, by the way? Kevin Kiermaier,
yeah.
So the Jays pitchers have been pretty fortunate. And you mentioned, you know, the gold glove, platinum glove, it's imperfect. The way it works, for anyone who doesn't remember, whichever position you've played at the most is the one you're eligible for. And then there is a blend of data that's used. We don't know specifically what Sabre, who determine these things, which stats they look at. You would imagine they would approximate defensive runs saved or outs above average, the ones we're always referencing, where Varsho's top of the league at both positions. And then managers and coaches also vote. You can't vote for your own guy. But I'm sure Brendan Hyde at this point is very, very aware of Dalton Varsho's defense out there. And the other note on this is Varsho has now played more innings in center field than left field on the season. He's only going to play center field the rest of the way here, I'd imagine, Keegan. So, yeah, we can lock in. He can pad the center field stats from here and help his chances. Platinum glove is one thing. It's a best overall defender. But the reason he didn't get a gold glove last year is because this little split between left and center field. I think we're full-time center field the rest of the way, and that clears him up a little bit here, Keegan.
It has to. I feel like that's going to be a trivia question years from now, at the lamest trivia you could ever go to. But the fact that Dalton Varsho played left field for a couple of years is ridiculous. Kevin Kiermaier is the only reason possible that Dalton Varsho could have played left field. But he'll be in center now, where he belongs very much for the next few years. And he's not going to slow down. He's still the right age. He's still entering his prime, incredibly athletic. Like, this isn't going to go anywhere. He is going to be the guy we talk about, like we now talk about Kiermaier, what he did over a decade. That's going to be Varsho, I think.
And look, the other trivia question around Dalton Varsho's defense is going to be, oh, what position was he originally? Oh, he was a catcher, and then just learned that, oh, he played second base and third base back when he was a teenager and a college prospect. Man, ridiculous stuff from him. Don't think he ever played third base in the minors, but he was a fairly regular infielder as well.
The catcher stuff blows my mind. You know, catchers used to look like me. It was just the big guy on the team. You know, the fact that Dalton Varsho was catching at one point, I still remember down in spring training, Blake, I remember tweeting this out. I was standing behind the cages where you can watch a pitcher throw a bullpen, and you're essentially 5 feet behind a catcher, but with a cage in between. And I was standing there watching. It was 8 a.m. I'd probably slept a couple hours. I was half asleep. And suddenly I hear, hey, Keegs, how do I look? And it was Dalton Varsho flipping his mask up, just catching a bullpen to stay fresh. It's amazing that he's ever caught an inning at catcher. He never should ever again. But the fact he can do that is just wild.
Yeah, you wouldn't – at this point, you're too valuable in center field. Center field is – you know, it's right there with shortstop and catcher. I mean, you might have a personal preference about which of those three you feel is the most important defensive position. I think what the Jays have shown us over the years is that you know, they put a value on the outfield and the catcher spot a little bit more than the infield spots. So let's pivot to the guy who is playing catcher the next little while. And if you were someone who wanted Dalton Varsho to get a spot inning at catcher, well, Danny Jansen's traded away. Gabriel Moreno's long gone. Isaiah Kiner-Falefa, who was the emergency catcher this year, he's been traded away. It's like, now is the time. You're not going to get it. Brian Servin would take those catching reps, and I'd imagine like Ernie Clement or Luis De Los Santos would be the emergency guy. Alejandro Kirk, though, big day yesterday. You wrote a good piece after the game, kind of contextualizing that this is the number one. He's got the number one job the rest of the way here. Maybe that's not something that carries into next year, but what are you seeing from Kirk the last little bit? What are you looking for the next little while here from Alejandro Kirk in what'll be for the first time really since Danny Jansen when he's injured, the lion's share of the playing time here?
Yeah, he's making harder contact now. And Kirk needs to make hard contact. And he's a guy who I still give some weight to batting average when I talk about him, because Kirk needs to have batting average. That's where a lot of his value does lie. And when he is not making hard contact, you see soft fly balls. You see ground balls. If he hits a ball on the ground, he's out every single time. And he needs to get that line drive stroke back that we saw in 2020, 21, especially 22, when he was an all-star, won that Silver Slugger Award. That's when he's at his best. Because when Kirk's swing is right, it seems like he hits the same launch angle every single time. Everything's a line drive, perfectly over the infielder's head, perfectly dropping in front of the outfielder. Now, of course, he made some better contact and hit that home run yesterday, but everything he hit was hard, which is important. Now, long-term, I still think Kirk needs to be part of a 1A, 1B, a tandem, whatever that looks like, whatever shape that is on the 60-40, we'll see. But he and Danny Jansen were, and maybe will be again, a perfect combination, I think, because you go back to 2022, Blake, which was Kirk's best year. You see him played in, I think, 132, 134 games, which is a bit deceiving because I think only 74 of those were catching. There were a lot of DH days, a lot of pinch hit days when he'd come in late in the game in the eighth or ninth. Keeping him fresh has to be a priority. I don't think he's going to go out and catch 120-plus games ever. I think that would be bad for him. I think that would tank his value a bit. But when you get him in the right tandem, and they had it at times with Danny Jansen, just injuries got in the way sometimes. They had that for a while, and I think that's the best of Kirk. He just needs to hit the ball with some force, because for the first few months of the season, Kirk was a slap hitter. And if you're going to be a slap hitter, you need to be fast. Alejandro Kirk is many things. Fast is not one of them. That's fine. So he needs to drive the ball a bit more. I think that's what we're seeing now.
Yeah, and you mentioned it. Even that season where he played in 139 games, 84 starts behind the plate. That is, you know, maybe you could push that to 90, maybe even 100 if he's like red hot or something. But there would be, it was interesting to hear John Schneider talk about after the game that, you know, he's, that playing more regularly helps at the plate. I think a lot of players would probably tell you that, hey, I'm getting more reps, I'm seeing the ball better, I feel more comfortable. But we also have this information that suggests when Alejandro Kirk is playing like 5 days a week, the offensive numbers have gone down because of the physical toll. I mean, I guess we're kind of just searching for the sweet spot here. We're the rest of the season is not going to be a search for that sweet spot because he's going to play as much as he can. No disrespect to Brian Servin and Phil Clark or Raposo or whoever else might come up. But looking ahead to next year, like, is that kind of the limit of what you'd be comfortable with? Like, when they go out and look for another catcher, it has to be a 70-80 game guy, not a 40-50 game guy. Do you think that's fair to say, regardless of what happens down the stretch here?
Yeah, a guy who can play about half the games and a guy who will probably cost you a bit of money. Every year, the Blue Jays do their minor league signings. This year, it was Servin and Peyton Henry. For a couple of years, it was Tyler Heineman. There's always going to be those guys in every organization, and that's good business. But this will be a year where the Blue Jays need to go out and spend a few million bucks, maybe over a couple of years, to get a legitimate big league catcher. Ideally, a guy that can add some offensive upside as well. You don't just want a defense first backup. This team needs offense. That's the reality of it. But keeping Kirk in that role where you're also comfortable DHing him the odd day if he's hitting. I do think sometimes the risk of DHing a catcher is a bit overblown. If it all goes wrong, yeah, you'll lose a couple at-bats. It won't be perfect, but how often will it go wrong? You know, you kind of knock on wood and hope. And the Blue Jays were aggressive with it in 22. With Kirk at DH, they've done the same with Jansen. It can work out. Ideally, you have a DH better than Kirk who can add some legitimate power, but yeah, we'll see where that goes. I think if you get a legitimate big leaguer, a veteran with some experience, Danny Jansen just keeps fitting this description. Frankly, you're looking for another Danny Jansen, and he's a free agent. But pairing him in the same type of timeshare, I think you need to target 2022 again. And Jansen and Kirk had such complementary skills. One guy could hit for power. The other was the contact guy who could get on base. Both of them managed a pitching staff very well. So, yeah, the Blue Jays are looking for another Danny Jansen, and his name might be Danny Jansen.
Which would be, you know, amusing. You get three prospects to rent him out for a couple of weeks here. Maybe it's a win-win situation on all sides there, Jays, Red Sox, and Danny Jansen. We'll see. The answer to this one is in part that you traded Gabriel Moreno away to get Dalton Varsho, and developing catchers is hard. Like, the long list of catchers of the future in any baseball organization is long and filled with guys who they're filled with Guillermo Quiroz and Robinson Diaz and Curtis Thigpen. I know this well because I will bite on any catching prospect ever. However, when you look at the Blue Jays' particular situation, and Phil Clark is the most notable name on the catching side in the minor league system, you have to go down to, you know, you have to go down probably to High A Vancouver with Jacob Sharp, who they just acquired, and Nicholas Deschamps, who they just promoted to that level, to find anyone who's like really a catching prospect. What do you make of that lack of catching prospect at the higher ends of the minor leagues for this organization?
Yeah, that's a weakness. Right now, you would love there to be even a number 25 prospect, a 25-year-old catcher who you could bring up, kind of someone in the position maybe where Riley Adams was a couple of years ago, a guy who was upper minors and had some sort of upside who you could take up and take a look at. The Blue Jays don't really have that right now. I do like Phil Clark a lot, and I think he is a guy who can come in, maybe get some reps down the stretch. High on base guy, does have a little more pop than the home run numbers do show. Running game's been a problem for him in AAA. I can never quite get a good read on how much to read into that in AAA. You've got AAA pitchers, different realities down there. There's some factors. And for catching prospects, there's so many more ways that things can go wrong. We focus so much on upside and what can go right for a prospect, but when you look at what can go wrong for a catcher, offense is its own thing entirely. There's game management, there's pitch framing, there's the running game. If you suck at one of those things, it's going to hold you back. There are more ways that you can be held back as a catcher, and you need to have such a broad and diverse skill set. And I think as you get up to single A into double A, one of those or two of those typically gets exposed. So it's really tough. The Blue Jays had a reputation, rightfully so, in the Moreno, Jansen, and Kirk years of developing catchers, developing them really well. John Schneider was a part of that, working with catchers at that time. So I think that does have to be a priority for them, kind of developing a bit more, backfilling that a bit more. But for now, they're probably going to have to go out onto the open market. Now, ideally, Phil Clark can be that guy next year in AAA, the version of what Servin or Peyton Henry were this year. He can be that internally. And I do like Clark. But I think the Blue Jays are missing a wave of catchers, maybe is the best way to put it. There's a couple levels that are missing a wave right now.
Yeah, it's a tough one. You know, it's just a tough thing to make heads or tails of. And again, the attrition rate on those is so high. But they did have, you know, you had Danny Jansen, Alejandro Kirk, and Gabriel Moreno at one point. You were the toast of the catching depth charts around baseball. Let's look at a couple other prospects here. Addison Barger showing a little life at the plate. What are you looking for from him down the stretch here? Yes, at the plate, but also we got to figure out what position this guy is. You know, we run the risk of going too far with Ray's brain of like, if you're not good at any position, but you can play all of them, that is not the same as being good at all the positions. Where are you on where Barger fits and, you know, what he needs to do the rest of the way here?
I want to see how he adjusts. And that's not the exciting, sexy thing to talk about with a prospect, but think back to David Schneider a year ago. He came onto the scene, hit everything, because pitchers weren't exactly preparing for him as much as they were preparing for Vladdy or Bo. That's going to happen to a young guy. Once Barger starts to have some success, veteran pitchers will pick apart his swing. They will see a guy bulging out of his jersey, ready to take the biggest swing they have ever seen, and say, okay, how can I use his aggression against him? That's a veteran pitcher's dream. How can I take this young guy who's trying to hit the ball 500 feet and make him look silly? It's up to Barger to make the adjustment to that, whether that's breaking balls, whether that's fastballs up and away, wherever that location might be. Pitchers will adjust to him. It's going to happen. And he'll need to win that adjustments game back. Because if he can, his physical skills, we know, are just incredible. The power he's able to produce at the plate, his throwing arm is ridiculous. From third base, from right field, it's the best we've seen in a long time in Toronto. The physical skills are there, but a lot of guys have physical skills. I think you need to see Barger win the adjustments game. And defensive position, I would like to see him nail down one, or even keep it to two, third and right field. Because, Blake, I the more we do this, the more I would just love a guy who plays a position. I don't know why. It simplifies things in my brain. But I think next year it will be more important because Kiner Falefa is gone. Biggio is gone. I think second base is going to need to be a little more simple next year. And left field, especially if it's Loperfido out there regularly, will be a bit more simplified. Earlier in the year, you could move in Biggio in and out. Schneider was moving in and out. I don't think that second base left field pipeline will be as fluid next year. And I think other positions could kind of calm down around that. There won't be as much moving next year, ideally. So Barger needs to nail one down. Has the arm to play anywhere. He can play outside the stadium. I don't care, but just needs to win that adjustments game.
Yeah, it's a tough one. It'll be interesting to see. And then in terms of what is on the line for him, and this is true of a lot of the guys, It's difficult to see, like, when you mentioned second base there, you know, I'd imagine that's a good chunk of Spencer Horwitz that you're referring to there. But a lot of these guys, whether it's Barger and Schneider at the higher end or, you know, Jimenez, Clement, De Los Santos, whoever, those guys are competing for largely for bench spots for next year, right? Like the holes that they have are bigger than guy looks good in August and September. Do you think that's fair to say?
Yeah, I think so. I would frame it, Blake, as a couple of these guys, like Jimenez included, would be competing for the role that Ernie Clement entered this year with, where he was kind of a part-time player, some thirds, some short, moving around. Those roles tend to expand into close to full-time roles every year. You look back through all of the years, there's always a utility infielder playing 120, 130 games. It's going to happen. But ideally, the Blue Jays are adding some legitimate MLB talent this offseason. They're going to have the money. They need the offensive upside. It's very good to have this mix with Barger, with Jimenez, with Horwitz, with Clement. I don't think you're going to see all of them starting next year. That would be a youth movement. That would be a rebuild. These guys are fighting for those depth jobs next year, kind of like Clement entered 2024, I think, is a sweet spot where you're playing. You're part of the team. You're not just riding the bench. You're not Nathan Lucas a year ago, the 26th man that this team never uses. But ideally, the Blue Jays are making more of an MLB-level splash, and these guys provide the upside next year. That's how you build a better lineup.
Yeah, and I think that makes sense in addition to, obviously, you know, you're going out there and fortifying a little bit. Speaking of long-term plans, Mark Shapiro will speak to you guys around 2:15, 2:30 this afternoon. What are you anticipating from that conversation? You can go wherever you want with that, as serious or as sarcastic as you'd like. But what's front of mind for you? This is the first time we've spoken to Mark Shapiro with the cameras and mics on since, I believe, spring training.
Been a minute. It has been a minute. I am interested to hear about baseball because I cover baseball, not infrastructure. I understand why we have had to talk about buildings and renovations quite a bit over the last couple of years. I get it. That's a lot of money, big changes, and that does fall under the business side of Mark Shapiro's job as team president, which is a very real part of his job. He does not spend his entire day lurking in front office meetings secretly informing what happens in trades. The business side's a real part of what he does. But today I want to hear about baseball. I want to hear his thoughts on what the front office has done. I want to hear his thoughts on Ross Atkins. I want to hear his thoughts on John Schneider, because his thoughts on all of those matters are the most important thoughts at this point. He is speaking to us after the trade deadline, which I do not believe is a coincidence. This is a major moment for the organization, where they're at right now. There have been some major moments already over the last year. All of those major moments have gone very poorly, whether it be this season, the last couple of playoff appearances. Nothing has gone according to plan. And when we speak to Atkins and Shapiro at this juncture of the season, like, I keep thinking back to the end of last year and how things ended. The belief from this organization that that was a blip on the radar. I think that was Ross Atkins' wording, that this was a blip. This team will bounce back. Why hasn't it? Why have you found that this team has not bounced back? It's I know there's a lot of minds and, my goodness, a lot of meetings going into that. But what answers have you come up with? What's the reason? What's the theory? What's the hypothesis at this point? And if this group is going to be together again in 2025, I'm talking Shapiro, Atkins, Schneider, what will be different this time? Why will this second or third or fourth pivot be different from the last one and the last one and the last one? Really, baseball side is what I'm interested in hearing about today from Mark Shapiro. And I think we see at these end of year press conferences, whether people like what he says or not, I think he handles those well and dances that dance well, which is a talent for an executive. And what Shapiro says typically matters. He does not say stuff off the cuff. He's normally thought it out. And I'm very interested to hear his thoughts on where the baseball side of this organization is right now. The business stuff, the building, the hard hats, construction, that's pretty much over. It's baseball time, and that's what I want to hear about.
Yeah, Corona rooftop patio, no disrespect, but I would like to hear, you know, how this team is going to actually score runs next season after a couple off seasons of taking a step in the wrong direction there. I think that's really well said, Keegan. I think, I don't know how much clarity we'll actually get on, you know, what this front office structure looks like heading into the offseason. We're still evaluating, believing the pieces. I'd imagine there's an element of that. I hope you're right that the baseball strategy, there is some clarity on what they believe has gone wrong and how to remedy that. Going to take a hard pivot here for a goofier one before I let you go. Last night, watching the Atlanta Braves game, and Big Boy from Outkast is doing play-by-play at one point. You get to run Sportsnet for a day. Dan Shulman and Ben Shulman call in sick, and you get to pick a musician to do play-by-play just for an inning or two. I don't know. You can go Toronto specific if you want. You can go a little East Coast. Alan Doyle of Great Big C's on this show tomorrow. So we can go a little East Coast if you. Yeah, I'm seeing him on Saturday at Bud Stage. So you can go wherever you want with this. But, you know, Big Boy is very Atlanta. Outkast is very Atlanta. I thought that was fun. Who are you going with if you can put someone in that spot for a Jays inning or two?
Well, I've got to go East Coast. Alan Doyle was going to be up on my list. So tune in to Fan 590 tomorrow, people, if you want a real East Coaster. He would be up there. I would have to have the Rankin family up there. How about me calling the game alongside the first anthem at, I believe, both Exhibition Stadium and Skydome? Me and Ann Murray in the booth. The Songbird calling out the game. I know she's a Jays fan. You know, that would be an electrifying booth. I don't know if it would appeal to the younger demographic, because I probably appeal a bit older as well. But they can figure out their own thing. We're here for the older crowd.
That sounds like a pairing to me that breaks all borders of demographics. I'm here for it. I know our mothers and fathers would be here for it. Certainly, that's a great answer, man. That'd be a lot of fun. I will. I have no power here whatsoever, but I will see what strings I can pull about a Keegan. And look, MLB is doing the stat cast, like ESPN2 Sunday Night Baseball alt cast with Mike Petriello and Kevin Brown and a couple of, and Trevor May. Maybe we can do an East Coast alt cast. Like, the season's gonna get weird here. Let's really lean into it, man.
Yeah, uncensored, unfiltered, open bar. No analytics, the opposite of StatCast.
Yeah.
The Vibes Cast.
Lobster shells cracking in the background and things like that. Keegan, thanks for taking the time, man. Have fun with the Shapiro presser a little later.
Hey, I'll try. You got it, buddy. We'll see you soon.
Keegan Mathison of MLB.com, of BlueJays.com, surely will have you covered for a lot of what comes out of Shapiro this afternoon. Again, that's, I believe, 2:15 this afternoon. Those things aren't always exactly on time. I'd imagine we'll have a Sportsnet feed up of it either live or directly after. Sometimes they don't want those things to go live, and we're not allowed to tweet during them or whatever. But we'll see how today's goes, see how that's set up. I'd imagine we'll get some insight into the front office's thinking, but maybe not firm answers on some of the bigger picture questions that, you know, we would like answered right now, but they don't have an urgency to answer until the season is over. Exactly, I guess. Let's take a break. Let's talk about this Orioles team. Let's set up the rest of the series with Jeff Arnold, Orioles play-by-play voice. We'll also talk to Madison Shipman a little later in the show. Carlos Collazo of Baseball America joins us, talk some draft stuff now that the Jays guys have signed and are being assigned and making their debuts around the minors. I'll also talk some bigger picture MLB draft stuff and where the future of that event could go, particularly as it pertains to maybe in 2027 letting teams trade draft picks. We'll see. We'll see what Carlos thinks of it. Jeff Arnold, though, joins us next to talk Orioles as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Dive deep into Toronto sports and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays beat the Orioles last night, 5-2. They'll keep it going tonight, 7:07 down at Rogers Center. It's Bowden Francis against Trevor Rogers. Bowden Francis, by the way, he did come out of the bullpen on Sunday for a couple pitches, but per Arden Zwelling of Sportsnet yesterday, no pitch restrictions or concerns or anything like that. Obviously, it was just a couple of pitches. That would probably have been his bullpen day anyway between starts, so he's good to go. He did throw 5 2/3 innings last time he was out, and it was against the Orioles. So we'll see if he can build on that. I don't even know if I'm still on Bowden Island because I think I've moved to he's probably a multi-inning reliever, not a starter. But I do think he's better than the 5.64 ERA he owns, and the you know, obviously the first couple starts of the season are still a good chunk of that sample. He's been a little bit better since. And then, yeah, liked what I've seen when he's gone down to the minors and worked on things. Let's take a look at the Orioles side of things with Jeff Arnold. He is the play-by-play voice of the Orioles on the Orioles Radio Network and Masson. Jeff, good morning. How are you, man?
Blake, how's it going?
I am I'm doing pretty well. Before we talk moving forward and looking at the rest of the games, what did you guys find out after the game last night about Grayson Rodriguez being removed on short notice from that start?
So we learned that Grayson is dealing with a right lat problem. It sounded like he was fine when he threw his bullpen against the Cleveland Guardians, but he's going to go back to Baltimore for some testing, and my hope is that we're going to know more information about him today. Obviously, given the number of starters that the Orioles have lost this year, and given kind of how much Grayson means to the bullpen, everybody in Birdland is keeping their fingers and toes crossed that everything's going to be okay. But it certainly was a surprise. And, I mean, Albert Suarez did an incredible job filling in. But obviously our thoughts right now are with Grayson and hoping that this is not something serious.
Yeah, and, you know, obviously the Orioles added two starters at the trade deadline in Zach Eflin and Trevor Rogers. But those were not supposed to be insurance for future injuries. Those were to cover Tyler Wells, John Means, Kyle Bradish. What would things look like if Grayson had to miss time here? I'd imagine it's just Suarez in as the fifth starter, and you try to manage with a lesser bullpen from here. Is that a fair read on how they'd handle it?
I think that's kind of how it has to be, Blake, because Suarez was in your rotation before. He is still stretched out. You can put him back in there. Another note, and it's kind of bad timing, but Chase McDermott, who has been up with the Orioles before earlier this year, he had to go on the injury list with a shoulder problem yesterday. So who knows what the rest of his year is going to be like. He's down at AAA for us. Cade Povich is down at AAA. He struggled when he's been with the Orioles. So I think your option is to go with Albert Suarez, and the Orioles are pretty lucky that they've got a guy like Albert who can go between the rotation and the bullpen and who did an amazing job last night.
Yeah, pretty lucky to have him able to step in and throw five shutout yesterday and, you know, at least save the ball. I know they ended up having to use five different relievers in that game, or four different relievers rather, including Gregory Soto having to throw 30 pitches, but really did save them there. Suarez has kind of, I don't know, it's felt like he's done that for them a lot this year, bouncing between roles, being pretty effective, kind of doing whatever he's needed. How valuable has he been to Brandon Hyde as this kind of Swiss Army knife pitcher?
Well, I think if you're going to have a year like the Orioles are hoping to have, it's going to mean at least one or more great stories of people that come out of nowhere and help you out. And Albert Suarez has been that guy for the Orioles. They got him from the foreign leagues. And he was somebody that our pro scouting department had a lot of interest in for a while. But the thing is that when you go into the off seasons in Korea and Japan, they tend to sign free agents very quickly. And so when our pro scouting people would check in about Albert and his availability, he was usually under contract. And then he suffered a calf injury last year. Orioles were able to bring him over. And we remember we were seeing him in spring training, and he faced the Phillies A lineup in Clearwater. It was Harper, it was Schwarber, it was Trey Turner. And he threw, I think, 8 strikeouts in 4 innings and didn't allow any runs. And we're like, who is this guy? And he got on everyone's radar at that point. And even though he didn't make the team out of camp, I think we knew that he was going to spend some time with us, or in the case that for Albert, most of the year with us. And since then, he's fulfilled every role we've needed him to. We've used him in high leverage. We've used him in long relief. He's been part of our starting rotation. And I don't know where we would be without him, especially when we were in the month of June and everybody was like, how are we going to get through this now that we are down John Means and Kyle Bradish and others? It really, I don't know where this team would be if Albert Suarez wasn't a part of it.
Yeah, it's hard to say. And a huge credit to Suarez for being able to do that and, yeah, succeed in multiple roles. I can't imagine it's easy. The Jays have kind of tried to use Trevor Richards that way the last couple of years. He's, of course, with the Twins now. So, yeah, interesting to see, and good for the Orioles to have that. So saves the bullpen a little bit. Today we'll see Trevor Rogers, his second start as an Oriole. Didn't go the best the first time around. But in this bet on Trevor Rogers, the Orioles picking him up at the deadline, how much are they looking at what he was able to do back in 2021 before the injuries and things like that, and hoping they can get more out of him than maybe Miami was?
I feel like they think there's much more in there for Trevor Rogers than he was showing with the Marlins. And he's dealt with injuries in the last couple of years, but the hope is that the Orioles can get him back to the form that he showcased in that all-star season that he had. And the first time around, he's facing the Guardians, who is a sneaky good offense. And on top of that, he'd gotten to the Orioles the day before. So he shows up in the clubhouse and he's next to Adley Rutschman, and Rutschman is telling him, oh, I'm catching you today. And Trevor doesn't know him at all. And he's spending time at the hotel, getting to know some of the Orioles pitching people. And they're trying to devise some kind of a game plan for that night, realizing that, all right, it's kind of go out there and do the best you can. But now that he's had a week to digest everything, that they've been able to look at his arsenal, he was saying yesterday that they're probably going to tweak some things that he does mechanically, maybe tweak some of his pitch usage type things, hopefully get the velocity back up to where, to a little closer to where it was. Because what we saw last time with Rogers is he didn't have a whole lot of margin for error because he was sitting like 92 to 93. So he's got to be pretty pinpoint with his stuff. But our pitching people are really good. They've had success, you know, with people such as an Albert Suarez type in getting them back to spots where they used to be, or giving them tools that maybe they didn't have before. And I look for him to be a lot better the second time.
Well, that'll be interesting to watch how that continues there, because, yeah, I mean, this is a guy who was very, very good not that long ago. It would be a fairly reasonable bet there. Because we won't talk to you before tomorrow's game, I did want to ask you about Dean Kramer as well. He'll start the finale of this series tomorrow. 5.22 ERA over his last 8 starts, and the walks have creeped up. This is normally a guy who's, you know, in the 2.5 to 3 walk per 9 range. What have you seen from Kramer? What is Kramer trying to kind of iron out here as the season wears on?
Like, I think some of it has been the defense has been really poor behind him. They have cost him some runs. 2 outings ago against the Padres, he was great. I think it was the best stuff that he'd had all year. But there were some unfortunate errors behind him that led to a number of unearned runs. And then the last game that he pitched in Cleveland, I also thought he threw the ball pretty well. But there was a mistake in the outfield on a pop-up down the line that should have been caught. And Kobe Mayo kind of stopped, and because of that, Colton Cowser came sprinting on. He couldn't make the catch, and he was almost out of the inning, but instead it was a 2-run double. So I think that maybe some of what looked like struggles are kind of disguised behind some bad defensive play. But I think the stuff for him has been better since he's come off the injury list, especially these last 2 times out there. And hopefully his defense will play a little bit better behind him next time.
With respect to the defense, I know this has been a bigger talking point, and the hope is almost certainly, and the reality is almost certainly, that it's just been a blip here. But when it comes to Gunnar Henderson and the little bit of error issue he's had over the last couple of weeks. What have you made of that? Is it a case of him, hey, he's going to do some extra infield work, things like that? Or is this largely just considered, hey, you're going to have a bad week, a bad 2 weeks sometimes in the field?
I think it's because with Gunnar can get to balls that many shortstops can't get to. And so by him being able to do that, he'll rush throws every once in a while and he will take chances, and that will mean some throws that are over the first baseman's head, or maybe some poor throws. I'd say that it occasionally has been on routine plays, but it largely has been on harder plays for him to make. So I think that's what some of it's associated with. And then for the Orioles as a whole right now, I mean, take a look at the infield. You've got Ryan Mountcastle is the old guy over at first base, and he's 27 years old. And then Holiday is brand new, and Mayo is brand new at third base, and Henderson is still developing. I mean, he's still developing, but, you know, with Jackson Holiday and Kobe Mayo, you still have a long ways to go. And I know that our infield coach, Tony Mancelino, who's one of the best in the business, he's working diligently with both of those guys to get them up to speed, because Orioles like to play close games. American League East games tend to be very tight, tend to be very, you know, action-packed. And so it's going to be a matter of getting those guys coached up. And Mancelino did a really good job with both of them at spring training. And I would imagine that now that they're up here, it's going to mean a lot of early work and trying to get them up to speed as quickly as they can.
Yeah, 20-year-old second baseman, 22-year-old third baseman, 23-year-old shortstop. It's a lot of inexperience, but it's a lot of fun there. With Jackson Holiday back up, he homered again yesterday. Certainly seems like at the plate, the confidence is just fine given how this season started out. What are they looking for from Jackson Holiday to stick at the level this time?
Well, the first time around, it was a lot of swing and miss, and I thought it was a lot of swing and miss. It just fastballs in the zone, which he said was not typical for him, and I think for anybody is a little bit of a red flag in the big leagues. But the thing about Jackson is that he's great at making adjustments quickly, and he was doing that at AAA. And he's come up to the Orioles, he's looked like a completely different player. He had a hit off of Emmanuel Clase the other night, and I was looking at the numbers, and we know how nasty Clase is. I mean, he had given up like three hits and, I don't know, 80-something at-bats to left-handed hitters all year, and Holiday had the fourth one. And then I took Bassett deep last night on a cutter, which was just a mistake pitch in the middle of the plate, and then, you know, had the grand slam. I think that he's just got a lot more confidence going. I feel like he's a lot more relaxed and much more comfortable than he was the first time that he was here, because a lot of it was the pressure coming off the field. I mean, he would go into the clubhouse and there are a million reporters around him all the time. There are all these cameras around him. He's trying to get his feet wet. And I say that Jackson handled it as well as anybody could, but it's still a lot of pressure on somebody who is so young and trying to figure it out at the big league level. Now that he's gotten a taste of it, went down, fixed some of the problems that he has, he looks like the Jackson Holiday that I think we were anticipating he was going to be.
Yeah, and I'd imagine he has some helpful voices around him in, say, an Adley Rutschman, who came up a couple years ago with some of those same expectations. Obviously not 20 years old when he came up. With respect to Adley, you know, he had a bit of a weird one defensively last night. I don't think anyone questions the defense. Offensively, still a pretty good season overall, but that 755 OPS, a little lower than it was the last couple of years. The walk rate's down pretty significantly from his first couple seasons. What are you seeing from Adley Rutschman at the dish the last little while here?
It's one of the interesting things, Blake, when you mentioned about the walk rate. If you examine the lowest percentage of first pitches swung at, Rutschman is
right at the bottom,
baseball,
yeah.
Which doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I think that in the past, maybe Adley would get a pitch which was good to hit, and he would just let it go because he wanted something a little more perfect. And I think that was the case with a lot of our young hitters. And so I think it's a bit of an adjustment on his end, where if you get a pitch and it's a good pitch, but maybe not a perfect pitch, still try and swing at it and do some damage on it. I think that recently with Rutschman, when he's not been his best, it's been him expanding the strike zone. His strength has always been getting pitchers off the corners and into the middle of the plate. And once he does that, that's where the power comes from. And so he's hitting for some, you know, better power this year. But more recently, I think it's been a mix of expanding a little too much. Also, there's been some bad luck in there where he's hit some balls hard. They've also been right at people. Last night, for instance, where he hits one right at Guerrero and he makes a catch and doubles up O'Hearn at first base. So there's been a little bit of that too. I think that with Adley, though, it's still been an all-star year. And as we kind of move forward and get out of these dog days of summer, I look for him to probably get some more hits. And it just, it's also looked like these last few days, the at-bats have started to get a little bit better. And you're hoping that's going to continue.
Yeah, and I mean, a guy that talented is going to ebb and flow a little bit, and he'll figure it out like we've seen a lot of guys at that level do. Elsewhere in this lineup, we saw Eloy Jimenez last night, one of the deadline acquisitions there, a guy I have always liked. And like, I know he's not, you know, you look at the whole package and it's not star level. I've always liked him a lot for some reason. He's on my list of if the Orioles don't pick up those options for next year and the year after, you know, hey, left field / DH option. Did you like the Eloy ad here and what he can add as, you know, having a different right-handed hitting option, whether off the bench or in the bottom third of that lineup for Brendan Hyde?
Feel like with Eloy, he could definitely hit left-handed pitching, and that's, I think, a reason why we got him, because when the Orioles lost Austin Hayes to the Phillies, you need to find a way to lengthen your lineup again, and it was really noticeable, you know, in the days after Hayes left that, okay, this bench does not give you as much as you're accustomed to seeing. So you go out and get Eloy Jimenez, and, you know, Brandon Hyde has said that if he's hitting, he's going to play. And he's hit right-handed pitching well the last couple of times out there. He scorched one last night for a base hit in that at the end of the game. And then I feel like that the comfort factor for him is there because of his relationship with Brandon Hyde and Tim Cousins, who's our big league field coordinator. Both of them were with Eloy when he was growing up in the Dominican and kind of starting his career at 16 years old with the Chicago Cubs. So his relationship with those two goes back a long time. And I think that comfortability factor is going to factor in a lot and help him get more used to life up here in the major leagues. And he's gotten off to a really good start. He's dealt with injuries in the past and he knows that, but I think the change of scenery sometimes is really a big difference maker for players and, for Eloy, and going from the worst team in baseball to a contending team that has bigger aspirations, I'm sure that's an energy jolt too.
When it comes to those bigger aspirations, it's very, very tight in the American League East right now. Obviously, the Orioles a half game back of the Yankees here, a chance to add a couple wins here still at Rogers Center. What are you looking for big picture out of this Orioles team? You know, is it those guys filling in the rotation? Is it the bullpen holding steady, the young guys turning around? I know I'm oversimplifying here, but to wrap the segment, if the Orioles are going to win the American League East, they need to X over the last 7 weeks here.
I think that they need to pitch well. I think they need to play defense well. I mean, those are the kickers. And when you have young players in there at premium infield positions, it's a lot going to be on them. And can you catch the ball and can you make the routine plays? I think, you know, when it goes to somebody like a Kobe Mayo, it is you don't need him to do anything like Superman. You just need him to get some hits and you need him to catch the ball and do the basic stuff that's going to win you games. I think also getting Craig Kimbrel back to the form that he showcased before is going to be important. He's kind of working through some stuff right now. They've taken him out of the end of games, and it's been a committee where you've seen Cano come on and get a save. You know, you've seen Sir Anthony Dominguez finish out a game on Sunday. I think that this team, you know, can really get Craig Kimbrel back to where that he wants to be. Then that's going to fortify this bullpen a lot more. And he should have probably been an all-star in the first half. Clay Holmes was picked over him. I think it was kind of head scratching. Maybe that's looking at it through orange and black glasses, but I do feel like that if he is going well, he gives you another big element to this pen. He's one of the best closers ever. And as he works through some of these things right now, hopefully the stuff is going to tick back up again. And then you get your ninth inning guy back and it makes the bullpen all that much better.
Yeah. And he can stop hitting Vlad. Come on. Jeff, thanks for taking the time out today, man. Enjoy the rest of the series.
All right, Blake, take care.
Jeff Arnold, voice of the Orioles on the play-by-play side on the Orioles radio network, and Masson, depending on the series. One other Orioles note: James McCann underwent a nasal reduction realignment procedure yesterday. Obviously, you'll remember Yoriel Rodriguez kind of catching him in the face in that doubleheader last week, and he somehow stayed in the game and finished the first half of that doubleheader, so Adley Rutschman didn't have to catch 15 innings or whatever it was. And yeah, not a huge surprise that he eventually needed some help healing that nose up. Let's take a break. We'll get some help from Madison Shipman talking about this Blue Jays team on the other side as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Big guests and bigger opinions on everything happening in Leafsland. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays with a good win last night, 5-2. Some good Chris Bassitt, some good Alejandro Kirk, some good two-out hitting. Five-run inning, all coming with two outs in the sixth. Joined now by someone who was on the call for that game alongside Eric Smith, Madison Shipman of Sportsnet, of Blue Jays Central on the weekend and the radio call of this series. How are we doing?
Good, good. I just keep you on your toes, which with where I'm going to be on any given series. Am I going to be in the radio booth? Am I going to be in the studio? Got to tune in to find out, right?
Yeah, are you going to be at home? Yeah, it's especially this time of year. Like, it was not planned because, oh, the Jays might be bad in August, but like, everyone is kind of rotating around. Like, we've got Dan Schulman off at the Olympics.
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah. Tough day for Dan and I yesterday with the Canadian men's basketball team. Yeah, I can see the look on your face. So let's talk about the team that did win yesterday, which has been less common, the Toronto Blue Jays. Let's start with Dalton Varsho's defense. Talked about it a little earlier in the show. John Schneider saying after the game that they're spoiled. Chris Bassitt saying if he doesn't win the Platinum Glove, let's just get rid of it. Are you running out of ways to describe it when it happens on games or when you're breaking it down on Blue Jay Central? It's crazy.
It's almost to the point where he makes it look so easy and he does it on such a regular basis that you almost take it for granted. Now, of course, we all can appreciate just the athleticism, but the fact that he's able to do it over and over and over again, one, speaks to just how special of an outfielder he is. But like we talked about on the call last night, the pressure that he takes off of the pitchers because of how much ground he's able to cover in the outfield, it gives them the freedom to throw whatever they want to whoever they want to, because they know that Dalton Varsho is going to pretty much cover the entire outfield behind them. Like that's got to give them so much confidence out there on the mound. And that's something that's not necessarily going to show up on a stat sheet, but you just hear the appreciation that Chris Bassitt and Kevin Gausman and all the other pitchers on this team that they've had for Dalton Varsho and the effort that he gives on every single play. There was even one play yesterday where he thought about taking second base, just trying to see if he could catch it. It was Austin Slater that had just been put into center field, trying to see if he could catch him sleeping. And he hustles hard around first base. There's just not a play that Dalton Varsho takes off. So it's always something exciting to be able to watch him make those incredible plays. And I'm still just fascinated by how he's able to make them look so easy. And maybe it's because of my own shortcomings, and going back on fly balls was just never my strong suit, especially if you put a fence back there. But the fact that he's able to do it, whether he's in left field or center field, he can do it all over the place.
But you were primarily an infielder.
I was.
Different skills.
There's a reason.
That drop step and run like over your back shoulder is tough to get down.
There's a reason why I ended up being an infielder. And pretty much anytime there was a fly ball that was hit over my head, I was just waiting for the left fielder to call me off so that I didn't have to go any further back. That was my strategy.
Nice. Right. And I mean, seriously though, with Varsho, there are, I'd imagine there's a component where it helps the right fielder, it helps the left fielder in addition to the pitchers, because like, I mean, probably most of this is captured by defensive positioning, but if you're George Springer, you know, you can shade that right field line a little bit more than you could if Dalton Varsho wasn't out there, if it was George Springer in center field.
Yeah. And I think too, for somebody like Joey Loperfido playing in left field, how awesome is it to be able to watch Dalton Varsho on a regular basis and see the routine that he goes through to get ready for each and every game, or what he's reading from a batter, or the spin off of the bat, and little things like that that make a huge difference when you're trying to cover as much ground as he covers. The initial read off of the bat and the spin and the anticipation that comes with being able to make those reads. If I'm somebody like Loperfido, I am soaking up every single moment and trying to learn and trying to enhance my defense, because there have been times where Loperfido has really shown that he's a great outfielder himself. He made another nice catch. I believe it was in the first inning yesterday. He's got some good range too, but between the two of them being able to learn from each other, I think that's something that goes a long way for a young player.
And Lo Perfido, probably the backup center fielder at this point, if Varsho takes a day off or anything like that. So helpful there. And you mentioned, you know, some of this stuff is hard to quantify, right? Like, we can quantify the actual defense, but you can't quantify how it affects, you know, Chris Bassett's willingness to throw a north-south curveball that might be more of a fly ball pitch than a ground ball pitch. And he's like, hey, I think this is the right pitch. All I got to do is keep it in the yard versus, you know, if it was a bad outfield, maybe that's a double, right? That's the hard part to capture.
Yeah, and I think it can make you tense up as a pitcher too, or maybe try to strike somebody out when maybe you don't have as much confidence in your defense behind you. You're maybe trying to do something that's out of your comfort zone just to make sure that the ball doesn't get hit in a certain direction. But that's where that freedom comes with these pitchers and having Dalton Varsho behind them. They don't have to strike everybody out. They can let these hitters hit fly balls deep into the outfield because he's going to be able to cover that much ground and put on a show for everybody, what he's able to do on a regular basis. And it's not something that just happens, but he works on it and he's continued to work on it. So I agree with Chris Bassett. If you're not going to give him the platinum glove, just get rid of it.
Yeah. I mean, I think the only player who has like an argument against it this year, and this would come down to really how you feel about how we capture catching defense, is Patrick Bailey. That he's about the only one that with any of the numbers we can look at. And the way, as a reminder to the audience, the way this stuff works is there is a statistical component and a managers and coaches voting component. We don't know exactly how it all blends together, but if you're Dalton Varsho, so in what we can quantify, he has 50 defensive runs saved over the last two seasons. That is double what any other outfielder has. And I crunched the numbers based on how many innings he's played. That Varsho's defense alone across center field and left field would save their average pitcher 0.21 on their ERA over the last 2 years.
I think that speaks for itself.
So you go from a 4 to a 3.75 guy. That's pretty good for your ERA and for your next contract and things like that.
Huge difference. I mean, that in itself, you can look at the numbers all day long, but even just the way that he's able to make what would be extraordinary plays for another outfielder, for them to look as easy as they do because he covers the ground, because he's got that great first step, because of his reads off of the bat. Those are the things that make a big difference when he's out there. And I've said this before, I'll say it again. He makes an impact on every single game that he plays, even if maybe he doesn't get a hit up at the plate. But the way that he's able to sprint out of the box, his speed on the base pads, even yesterday, putting pressure on the outfielders to make a perfect play, or he's going to take that extra 90 feet. He just is somebody that continues to make an impact in different ways on every ball game that he's in.
Yeah, and then, you know, if he could get that OPS back up over 700, terrific. Hey, the average is back up over 200. That's a, you know, baby step.
He does have a knack for hitting the timely home run. They all seem to be go-ahead home runs. I can think of a number of them off the top of my head, but they seem to come at some pretty clutch times.
Yeah, and he was a part of that everyone was a part of that big five run, sixth inning yesterday. Let's pivot then to the hitting side. So the Jays do all of that damage, all the runs they score in that sixth inning. Everything happens with two outs from the first base runner on. So you get the Horwitz single, you know, Kirk hits a home run, and then Varsho and Clement. Ernie with the, I guess we still call it an intentional walk, the like, you're up 3-0, so just take the base, which was funny. A double steal, Barger with the double there. What does it tell you when the Jays can string that much together with two outs in an inning?
Yeah, I think that whole rally got started too with Vladdy, and he's been hitting the ball extremely well, and then you even get him in a two out situation and he still manages to find a way to get a base hit. From there, I just feel like they've done a good job of stringing together the quality at bats, and maybe it's coming from a mindset of not trying to do too much, not trying to hit a home run every single time, which I know is something that we've talked about for the past two seasons. But yesterday in that sixth inning really just felt like it embodied that, whether it was getting deep into account, finding a pitch that you can actually do something with, or going up there and being aggressive early, or for somebody like Ernie, who I think now has a grand total of, what, 6 walks on the season. Whether it's taking the walk and extending the inning, just those little things can go a long way. And I also think, too, for somebody like Alejandro Kirk, who I said this yesterday, I feel like has been swinging the bat extremely well recently, seeing the ball well up at the plate, for him to be in that opportunity to come through for the team and making those adjustments. And maybe you're not going up there trying to hit a home run, but when the opportunity presents itself in front of you, you go ahead and you crank that thing out of the yard. And I was surprised that they came back with a slider after he hit that, what was it, a curveball pretty much up into the 500 level on the left side. But hey, if they're going to come back with another breaking ball, you take advantage of it. So it just seems like they're finding spots to hit the ball with authority, pass the bat along, have quality at bats, really make these pitchers work hard out there. And it feels like it's making the pitchers uncomfortable out there on the mound just by the way that they're able to extend these innings, even with two outs.
Certainly Gregory Soto was. And yeah, you mentioned the going back to the breaking ball there when you throw like 98 from the left side. I don't know. I might have just done that. But I think if I could throw 98 from the left side, that's probably all I would do. And then I would be a predictable one pitch pitcher. With respect to Kirk, there's kind of this, you know, looking forward the rest of the season, there's this give and take between players tell us all the time that it's easier to get in a groove if you're playing every day. If you're getting regular at bats, you see the ball better, you feel better up there and stuff. But we also know that the catching position takes a pretty heavy toll from a workload and a physical perspective. And we've seen Alejandro Kirk's numbers dip when he's, you know, playing 5 days a week and things like that. How do you balance that the rest of the way? And I guess more importantly, given your experience, do you find that to be true? Like you can better stay in a groove if you're in there playing every day?
Yeah, I think it comes with the routine, and hitting is so much about timing and the rhythm and the movement and your load and everything that goes along with it. So, you know, theoretically, the more at bats you have, the more consistent at bats you have, the more consistent your timing's going to be, and thus you're going to have some better quality at bats. But this is something that Alejandro Kirk's had to deal with throughout his career, so I don't think it's anything out of the norm. But yeah, I do think that you still give him, making sure that he's still healthy enough to be who he is back behind the plate too, but give him as many at bats as you feel that he's comfortable with. And the way that he's swinging the bat right now too, you don't want to put him in the lineup so much that it starts to take away from the catching aspect. So I think that's where that balance part of it comes from, because he's so good at framing those pitches low in the zone. You want to make sure that he's feeling good enough to still give you that behind the plate, because that's something else that the pitchers will have a lot of confidence in too, knowing that he can steal some of those strikes. But also with the way that he's hitting the bat, I'm almost tempted to just like keep on putting him in that lineup, right? But so that's where that balance comes in from. I think that's where the open conversation between John Schneider and Alejandro Kirk's going to have to really come into play, is making sure that he's honest about how he's feeling back there. And not that he wouldn't be, but as a competitor, we want to be out there every single day. But just being realistic in the fact that I just don't want to take away from what I bring back behind the plate to be in the lineup every single day. So, you know, it's just that, like you said, it's that tough balance of trying to find what's going to work for everybody.
And maybe a good week for it and for getting him in there a little bit more. You just had two off days over a 5 day span, and now you've got four consecutive night games. You don't have that weekday day game after a night game, whatever. You can maybe ride him a little bit more before getting Brian Servin back in there. Elsewhere in that inning, Addison Barger takes a really tough low and away pitch down the line. And that is, yeah, it's a pretty professional style of hit to have. It's obviously big and scores two runs there. And it is, to me, very counter to the book on Addison Barger so far. What did you like about, I know he, you know, the overall numbers aren't there yet. He's still working off that early season slump. But what did you like about what that kind of at bat signals about where Barger's at?
Yeah, I think he looks a lot more comfortable in the box than he did earlier this season, and it could be some of the changes that he's made with his stance, and just like the rhythm and the timing of his load feels a lot more in control. And he is so strong, and at times it feels like maybe he was trying to overswing to hit the ball out of the ballpark when he doesn't need to do that. And I think we've seen that on several occasions now over the past couple of games, where he can pretty much just flick his wrists at the baseball and still hit it really hard. One of the hits that stands out to me too was actually playing the Orioles, what was it, a week ago in Baltimore. It was a 100-mile-per-hour fastball from Rodriguez that was outside, and he was able to take it the other direction. And what that tells me too is his ability to adjust to different parts of the zone. And when you're able to take away maybe the outside part of the zone, then pitchers have to figure out where else they're going to pitch you, and then they might come back into your strength, because ultimately he wants to be able to pull the ball out to right field and beyond. So what can you do to take away that side of the plate? Well, you put your hands out there, you hit a hard base hit the opposite direction, and then it forces them to change their game plan the next time you come up. So those are the things, the little things that I really have been encouraged by seeing from Addison Barger the past couple of games, and he's gotten some results from it too.
Is that a similar, what he is doing better in terms of controlling where pitchers are pitching him and trying to bring them back to kind of his hot zones, is that the same area you see David Schneider struggling with lately? I know there was a stretch early in the season where Pitchers, obviously, when he first came up last year, every pitcher was like high velocity, high velocity, high velocity until he showed he could hit it. And then this year, it was a lot of outside stuff. And now it's kind of all over the place. But what have you seen from him? I know he wasn't, he wasn't in there last night, but he had played the four games prior. What are you seeing with David Schneider?
Yeah, I feel like it's one of those tough spots as a hitter when you're trying to get back on track, where there's a part of you that wants to be selective and making sure that you're going after the pitch that you're hunting in a specific at bat. But then also making sure that you're not taking away from the aggressiveness. And there have been some times where he's gotten some fastballs that are pretty much low in the zone, but right in the middle that are his sweet spot that I feel like he's letting go by, maybe because he's anticipating what he thinks he might see from the pitcher. And that's a tough spot to be in as a hitter. And it's so funny when you think about hitting, because when you're on and when the game feels like it's moving in slow motion and the baseball feels like it's about the size of a beach ball, you think, oh, this feeling's never going to go away. And then when it finally does go away, then you're trying to figure out, how do I get back to that feeling? How do I get back to where the game just feels like it's in my control the entire time? And sometimes it might just take one swing. Maybe it's just one at bat. Maybe it's a mechanical adjustment to get your mind off of the pitch selection side of things. But that's where I felt at times with Davis Schneider and his at-bats, is maybe he's taking some of those fastballs low in the zone, which we know is his area that he can absolutely crush. And then you get into a spot where you're behind in the count, and then you start fishing at some of those breaking balls away. So it's trying to find that nice balance of still being aggressive at pitches that you want to hunt, and knowing that the strike zone's the same no matter what the numbers say before you step into the batter's box, and no matter who's out there on the mound, but they still have to throw it into that strike zone, and kind of taking control back of the at-bat with that mentality, I think, can go a long way.
Yeah, and we'll see if he's able to pull that back the rest of the way here. Obviously, like we've talked about a bunch, early competition now for 2025 roles, and you're making your early auditions. You don't want to fall behind this early, even though obviously he has a bit more of a track record than some of these guys. Last one on the hitter side for you. What have you learned about Joey Loperfido so far at the plate? I know we talked about his defense a little bit earlier, but what are you figuring out about him at the dish?
I really like his swing too, and I would say the same thing for Leo Jimenez as well. I know he hasn't quite had the results, but between the two of them, I like their swings and their little things in as far as adjusting to the pitches out of the hand that I think can go a long way. I try not to look directly at results. I know, of course, baseball's so numbers-based, and it's easy just to look at the numbers, but like little things within the at-bat, and maybe it's a good take here or there that I really think that you can build upon, which I know we've got this long stretch here at the end of the season where you're looking towards the 2025 year, but I think that there are some things that I've seen from Loperfido and his swing that can really can go a long way. So I like it so far. I like his approach. I like his presence in the box, too. So I think it's something that he can build upon, and I hope he gets some more at-bats so that we can see what else he can do.
And that's how he ends up with more pink in the book than green or yellow or blue.
What I was going to say, I'm very color-coordinated.
There is a good chunk of the audience that it doesn't have the benefit of video for this, but I am curious about the color-coding to how you score the game.
Yeah, so if you're hitting, you definitely do not want a color by your name, because that's how I highlight the strikeouts.
Okay.
So the different colors are the different pitchers that come into the game. Gotcha. So I typically start with pink. Those are the starting pitchers. And then from there, I highlight. So that way I can look down very quickly and see how many strikeouts a certain pitcher has. So if you're batting in the lineup, you want to see absolutely no color next to your name. That's the goal.
A lot of pink there for Chris Bassett.
Yes. Oh, he was so good last night. Just so efficient. I turned to Eric at one point in the game, and I just felt like every single batter was getting behind 0-2, 1-2, and that's a product of just how efficient Chris Bassett was yesterday.
And I thought it was awesome. You know, it looked like he dealt with a groin thing at the end of the second inning. He went into the clubhouse with the trainer at one point. I was like, uh-oh, this is a bullpen day to start the series, and he just guts it out. And like, coming off a couple of rough starts too, I don't know, there's not a time that I'm going to doubt that Chris Bassett will figure it out and be able to give you, I mean, in this case, 7+.
Yeah.
Good innings.
What was it? July statistically was his worst month of the season. His ERA was inflated, like up over 7 for just the month of July. But for him, and he's been around the league for a long time, he's not going to be fazed by those things, and he's not going to let one start snowball into another. But I was fascinated too because of how efficient not just Chris Bassett was, but Suarez, who got the start at the last minute with the last minute scratch of Grayson Rodriguez. But between the two of them, they were so efficient that both pitchers had hardly any rest time in between innings. It felt like as soon as they ran off the field, they had about, 45 seconds, and then they were back out there on the mound. So I was really impressed with the pitch mix specifically from Bassett, because with him being right-handed and all the lefties with power in the lineup for the Orioles, I thought, know, statistically might not be the best matchup for him, but it was really the sinker cutter combination that I really liked on the outside part of the plate to those lefties, because one, of course, is going to break away from them. The other one's going to have a little bit of cut in. And being able to utilize both of those pitches coming in the same location and then at the last minute breaking in a different direction, I felt like that was something that he could build upon early in the count and then go to some of his breaking balls. It just felt like he was ahead as far as what the batters were looking for, like one pitch ahead the entire game, which is exactly where you want to be if you're a pitcher. And he was moving at a really quick pace, too. You could tell that he had a good feel for his pitches, too, because he was not taking a lot of time in between pitches.
No, and maybe one mistake all game, a cutter that didn't quite cut in against Jackson Holliday. And even the stuff in the eighth was like nibbling stuff.
Yeah.
It wasn't big mistakes.
And if you're going to give up a home run, you want it to be a solo shot, right? Yeah. You just give your team a chance, and that's what he did. And you tip your cap to Jackson Holliday for capitalizing on a mistake, and then you just keep on going.
We will see Bowden Francis tonight. He is coming off against the Orioles, the longest outing of his career, 5 2/3. Weird season where obviously it did not go well those first couple starts. He goes to the bullpen. He goes to AAA and has like a sub-1 ERA as a starter. He's throwing the splitter and the curveball more. What would it mean to you if we come out of tonight saying, yeah, Bowden Francis built on that 5 2/3 outing, and it was only 3 earned runs. It wasn't even, you know, a quality start or a gem or anything like that. But when you are just trying to get your footing as SP5, for this team, what would that mean to you that Bowden Francis was able to build on that one?
Yeah, the one thing that I always like from Bowden Francis is he doesn't let one inning impact the next. And when you look at that last start against the Orioles, I believe he gave up those 3 runs in the first 2 innings of the ball game and then just really settled in. And this is not a lineup that it's easy to settle in, especially the more looks that they get at you. I think that just shows the growth that he's had as a pitcher. And plus, he's been going all over the place, right? You just mentioned it, all the different spots that he's been in, even just this season alone, and going in a starting role and a relief role, long man role, doesn't matter. But he's going to give you his best effort every single time that he goes out there. And I think he's able to adjust to what the batters are looking for, too. Early in that ball game against Baltimore, he gave up, I would say, a couple of mistakes, but they weren't necessarily bad pitches. I think they were just better swings that the Orioles put on them. But then he was able to nibble on the outside parts of the zone. And I do think that splitter is going to continue to be a pretty important pitch for him, especially against those left-handed batters. But for him to be able to continue to get better in that ball game, I would just hope that when he's able to go out there and get the start tonight, that he can build upon that in the sense of continuing to find ways to get these batters out, even though he's seen them several times over the past week and a half.
Yeah.
So, and it's not going to be easy with this lineup, but I think with his mentality that he brings out there and the fact that he's got a bunch of different pitches that he can throw to. But I do think, kind of going back to our Dalton Varsho conversation, relying on the defense to help you out in certain spots is going to be a big deal.
Yeah, and keep the ball in the yard then is the challenge for you as a starter. And yeah, you mentioned that splitter. I mean, with how many lefties the Orioles can trot out there, you know, that tends to be one of our more split neutral pitches. He actually has worse numbers against righties than lefties on the season, maybe because the curveball's been ineffective and the splitter's been a little better. But that'll be an interesting one to watch. Last serious one for you. Mark Shapiro is going to speak to media today before the game. I think it's like 2:15, so you get a nice long day where you get to be down there the whole time. My colleague JD Bunkus on the JD Bunkus podcast does this regular thing when an exec is going to speak, called the truth serum question, which is if you could make sure 100% he had to answer completely honestly, what would you ask Mark Shapiro?
Oh man, that's a tough one. That's a great question. I feel like my mind's going straight to Vladdy, right? Okay. Like that's kind of where my mind's going. Like what's the future for him look
what's
like?
The number?
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of where my mind's going right now, especially, and it could be given the way that Vladdy's been hitting over the past, what it feels like, several months now. And just his numbers in comparison to even some of the other top hitters across Major League Baseball, that's where my mind's going, is the numbers for Vladdy.
Yeah, what is the number you're comfortable with, and what is the number he's comfortable with? Because I'd imagine after the last 40 games or so, there's a gap there in what number. Last actual one for you, and I'm going to put you on the spot with this one, but it's a little goofier.
Okay.
So I'm watching part of the Braves game last night, and Big Boy from Outkast comes on. He's doing play-by-play. Eric Smith calls in sick tonight. Ben Schulman is on TV. Dan Schulman is obviously in Paris right now. And they're like, all we have on the dial are musicians.
Okay.
Who are you picking to do the call with from? And it doesn't have to be a Toronto person or a Tennessee person necessarily. Obviously, Big Boy has the Atlanta ties.
But. Yeah, just anybody who I'd like to call the game with. Well, I mean, I've been watching the Olympics a ton, so Snoop Dogg is the first name that comes to mind. I feel like that would be entertaining. I love Lil Wayne, so I would love to see Lil Wayne and I in the booth calling a game.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why not?
Yeah,
let's do
that.
It. Let's
I
do
mean,
it.
He's a huge sports fan. He's this is like a running bit. He is a fan of every sports team because depending on the game, he's in Packers gear, Saints gear, Cincinnati Reds gear, whatever he could do. He's a big wrestling guy. Yeah. There's nothing. Lil Wayne's a great pick. That'd be
LSU
great.
Women's basketball, too. Yeah. I mean, he's a fan of all sports. Right?
Yeah.
Why not throw
who's
a little
not a fan of that LSU?
That is true. That is very true. Very true.
And that is Louisiana, obviously.
as I they see what say. You did there.
Yeah. All right. Madison Shipman, thanks so much for taking the time out. Have a great call later.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
All right. Madison Shipman of Sportsnet, Blue Jay Central last series, the radio call alongside Eric Smith this series on the Sportsnet Radio Network. We're going to take a break. When we come back on the other side, we'll talk to Carlos Collazo of Baseball America. All the Jays draft signings are done. Most of those guys have been assigned to minor league levels. What do we like about it? What are we encouraged by? And yeah, let's talk some MLB-wide draft stuff because there's been a lot of chatter coming out of this year's draft that teams would maybe like the league to let them trade draft picks in the future. We'll see what Carlos thinks as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jay's back in action, 7:07 down at the Rogers Center. Ben, Buck, and Arden on the TV call for you. Jamie and Joe on Blue Jays Central. Eric and Madison, who we just spoke with on the radio call, and Shy. I assume all our people are down at the ballpark today. I was going to say Shy covering for Sportsnet.ca, but Mark Shapiro speaking at like 2:15. Maybe you want to ask him, hey, man, how come in the latest Baseball America rankings, despite all the trade deadline additions, Carlos Collazo just tweeted it out and you guys only rank 23rd still. We know the answer to that. We've been talking about it a lot since the draft and the trade deadline, but we'll talk to Carlos Collazo about it in a little bit here. Let's take a look at the way things shape up for tonight. It's Bowden Francis against Trevor Rogers. Trevor Rogers, who has had better days than what he's shown so far this season. If you go back to 2021, he was quite the pitcher for Miami. Dealt with some injuries, had a very bad 2022, didn't pitch much last year, and the strikeouts have never come back. He sports a 4.76 ERA and even worse underlying metrics. Does an okay job keeping the ball on the ground, but otherwise doesn't get a ton of whiff, doesn't get a ton of strikeout. The exit velocities aren't great. Below average level of chase, so how often you get a guy to swing outside the zone. And he was hit pretty hard in his Baltimore debut. Five runs over 4 1/3 inning against Cleveland. He had been a little better before Baltimore acquired him. He had a 3.17 ERA over his last 9 starts before the Orioles picked him up. We'll see which version of Trevor Rogers we see tonight. The Jays will see a lot of fastball, changeup, sinker, slider. Lefties, of course, won't see that changeup nearly as much because that tends to be an opposite-handed pitch. Teams have, on average, really stacked the righties against Trevor Rogers this year, which will be interesting given that the Jays have a couple everyday lefties right now in Barger, Horwitz, Joey Loperfido, and Dalton Varsho. Would imagine a couple of those guys get a night off and are available off the bench. Let's take a look down a little lower on the farm, guys who aren't on the major league roster yet, but could be in the mix in a little bit here. Let's talk to Carlos Collazo of Baseball America. Carlos, what's up, man? How are you?
How are you doing? Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for coming on. Thank you for dropping. I mean, I know it's not just you, it's everyone at Baseball America, but the updated farm system rankings, like right as you came on here, right down to the wire. Before we get into Jay's specific stuff, you've had a couple weeks now to sit with the draft, to sit with the signings and how everyone shapes up afterward. Everything go like pretty true to form? Like, did you come out of it thinking anything new, anything differently than kind of the way we'd previewed it coming in?
Yeah, there are surprisingly few wild picks. I expected the first round to be a lot more chaotic than in fact it was. There were only a few players that were slight off the board selections. We had guys like Dante Norrie, PJ Morlando, Braylon Payne, who went a little bit earlier, but all those guys ranked as top 80 prospects for us coming in. A few guys slid down the board a little bit more than I expected. J.J. Weatherholt with the Cardinals, Treya Savage, who was the Blue Jays' first-round pick. I would have taken those guys a lot higher than they went. But I think overall, in terms of how we compare this draft class to a typical draft, a standard draft, just a lot fewer surprise picks, particularly on day one. So I think in general, things went according to what we expected, what teams were telling us prior to the draft. Maybe four players not signing inside the top 10 rounds is a little bit higher than we've seen in recent years. I think you have to go all the way back to 2018 before you get a draft where that many players who were selected inside the top 10 rounds didn't sign. But overall, I think the names we expected to see went kind of the ranges we expected to see in the first two or three rounds or so.
With respect to a few more names than usual not signing in those first 10 rounds, my instinct and a question I had for you heading into the draft was, you know, maybe the NIL environment is it better able to get guys to go to the college route or whatever. You had tweeted not too long ago that you think it's overstated. What if the NIL effect on the draft is overstated, what do you make? Is it just kind of just a perfect storm for those couple guys that where college makes more sense than signing in at, you know, sixth round slot, eighth round slot kind of thing?
Yeah, I just think with NIL, I think a lot of people use it as kind of a blanket reason for a lot of things that happen in the draft that maybe have more complicated causes. I think really in general for high school players, the draft has gone to a more college heavy system over the last few years. That has not been something new or recent. Teams want college players. They want faster moving players. I think this year, you can look at the guys who didn't sign, and there are a lot of reasons for those players didn't sign. I think Jackson Jelkin, it sounds like just medical, the fact that the Mets didn't even offer him a deal. They clearly weren't happy with the medical they saw after the fact. That has nothing to do with NIL. I think with Chris Lavonis and Tyler Bell, maybe it's just questions of signability, not getting that nailed before the draft, or teams or players reassessing after the fact. I don't really think those have too much to do with NIL. Ryan Prager maybe has a little bit more to do with NIL, but I just think in general, there are a few players who are getting significant NIL deals in college. A vast majority of the players, I don't think, are getting the sort of NIL deals that are going to steal them away from top two rounds, top three rounds money in the draft. I just think it's one of those scenarios where a couple players, it didn't work out for whatever reason. This happens. I just don't think that every college baseball team in the country is funding NIL to this level. The SEC certainly is, and some schools in that conference more than others. But more than anything, I just think college players are what teams want. I think there are certain players that are getting squeezed out of the minor league system. NIL is certainly a factor. It's obviously different nowadays. So I would just hesitate to say like, oh, all of these high school players are going to school because of NIL. Like a lot of these high school players would be going to school in a pre-NIL system anyways.
Right. Helpful context. I'm sure the NIL is a nice back pocket thing, but not the reason you're making this, at least at the very high end of things. Let's take it to the Toronto Blue Jays specifically. They had two of those guys who didn't sign, but they were their 19th and 20th round draft picks in Damarian Terrell and Bryce Martin Grudzelanek. I know Damarian Terrell is a guy that you guys at BA have been high on, had him as a top 100 guy. I think the number 12 ranked player who at a high school who didn't go the draft route and is going to college. When the Jays took him at the 19th, did you see that pretty much as a foregone conclusion? He would end up going to Auburn still?
Yeah, with the 20 round draft, really, I don't like say, oh, none of these guys are going to sign if they're going 19 to 20, because there are a number of teams who are signing really the entirety of their draft class. And sometimes that's high school players 16 to 20. I think for most teams now, you are a little bit skeptical of the high school players who are in that 16 to 20 window if they're going to sign. The Jays did sign Gavin Smith in the 17th round. I thought that was a really intriguing signing. But I do think it's pretty smart for teams to maybe take some of these, I wouldn't call them necessarily backup options, but high upside players, draft them. If something happens to one of your picks up top, like I think you saw the Brewers did this, they took a bunch of players on day three from the high school ranks. And when they didn't get their deal signed early on, one of these guys were talking about in the top four rounds, they were able to push some extra money down to those players and get them signed. So I think having a player that you can push money to if things don't go according to plan is smart. We saw how a few years ago when the Mets didn't sign Kamar Rocker, they went under slot with a lot of their picks in the first 10 rounds to save money for that pick. They lost the slot value and then really lost that savings because they didn't have sort of a backup option they could push the money to when things didn't go as planned. So I think it makes sense to take Terrell there in the 19th round. If that was the plan, he could be a player they really liked that maybe they were hoping they could get him signed if something happened up top. I do really personally like him. We had him as a top 100 prospect. He's got a lot of tools. He's got a lot of upside. I'll be excited to see how he's able to kind of improve as a pure hitter in college. But yeah, I think in general, looking at the Jays draft, like seeing what they did in the top 10 rounds, I like a lot of the arms they took, and they took some intriguing data guys as well.
Yeah, they did. Then they went over slot on two guys pretty significantly in Johnny King, who, you know, was a high enough pick that we figured that would happen. And then not quite the Terrell situation because he was a 12th round guy, but Carson Messina going 400K over slot for those guys as well. When you look at what they did with their money generally, before we get into some of the, you know, I did want to ask you about Sean Keyes. I know he's a data guy, and Treya Savage, who ends up being one of the best values based on how BA evaluates these things. But going over slot on a Johnny King, on a Carson Messina, did you like how the Jays used their pool money around this draft?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, one of the strengths of this year's class was some of this high school pitching depth. That was a demographic that I was really curious to see how teams would target it in this draft class. Typically, it's a very high risk, high reward profile. Some teams are more opposed to taking shots on that profile. I think both Johnny King and Carson Messina, we viewed those guys as top 150-ish players. I think we had them both in sort of the 80 to 130, 140 range. So solidly top five round guys. I think makes a lot of sense with what they've done historically, but they're both very young for the class. I think there's a lot of upside potential. They both can spin the ball pretty well. Carson Messina, particularly in the 12th round, getting a guy who maybe has a chance for a double plus slider, I think is a really exciting pick. So I think these are two upside players with a lot of talent that you want to take a shot on. The fact that you didn't have to draft maybe the riskiest profiles with your first two picks, I think, is maybe encouraging. You can kind of layer on some of this upside after securing what I would think of as maybe safer profiles early on, certainly with Treya Savage as your first overall pick. I think that is a phenomenal pick for the Jays. But yeah, in general, I think if I were drafting in this class, I would have wanted to take a lot of shots on some of these really talented high school pitchers who really, once you get to the 50 to 60 spots on our BA 500, like going down through the next 50 to 100 players, there's not a ton of separation. So if you can pick off a few of those players and get them signed, I think it's a really just nice way to infuse some talent and upside into the organization.
That's one part of the strategy for sure. And we know they could use some upside on the pitching side throughout the organization. Strategically, what did you make of, it seemed like in reading all the BA write-ups on these guys, there was at least a little bit of an emphasis on guys who had deep pitch mixes, guys who threw four, even five pitches. What did you make of that element of who the Jays targeted?
Yeah, I really like to kind of dive into these draft classes after the fact and see if there are any just themes that carry over. That was one of the things I could pick apart with the Jays. A lot of, especially their college pitchers, Treya Savage, Cal Steven, Jackson Wentworth is another one. Like all of these guys have very deep pitch mixes. I'm not sure if like specifically the Jays are like trying to find pitchers who throw a lot of pitches. I don't know why that would be the case, but I think it was just fascinating how a lot of the pitchers they took showed that. The high school pitchers, you see less depth of an arsenal typically with those players. They can kind of dominate with their fastball and whatever their primary breaking ball is. And I think for the most part, you see that with Johnny King and Carson Messina. But yeah, Cal Steven and Jackson Wentworth really seem to work deep into their pitch mixes. I personally like that. I think if you can show an ability to land a bunch of different pitches, it just gives you more options moving forward. Treya Savage, maybe he doesn't have the deepest pitch mix, but I think in terms of his top three pitches, some of the best in the class, slider, changeup. Some scouts prefer the slider, some prefer the changeup. I personally prefer his changeup. But the fact that he's got, I think of it as almost like a Rhett Lauder type pitch mix a year ago. He just has great feel for the fastball, slider, changeup. They work well in tandem. He can control them all. So I think with a lot of these college pitchers, you really have pretty polished arms in contrast to these high school profiles. I would imagine they move quicker. I imagine there's a little bit less risk. I mean, they're all pitchers. So we've seen that Blue Jays fans know maybe more than anyone how risky pitching prospects can be. They can get injured at any point. But in terms of skill, in terms of pitch ability, in terms of how advanced they are on the mound, I think they're pretty polished in advance, and I would expect them to move quickly if healthy.
Yeah, we heard from Shane Farrell, the Jays director of amateur scouting, the other day that, you know, at least with Yasavage and Kyle Steven, given the pitching loads they pitched in college, they're not in a rush to place them to, you know, A-baller or something like that. So we'll see. But yeah, it's certainly in the case of Yusavage, it seems like everyone thinks he could move pretty quickly. You also mentioned there, within the Jays draft, there are a couple quote-unquote data darlings. I know Sean Keyes in the, I think, fourth round is kind of one of those. What do you see in those guys? What makes a guy kind of a data pick?
Yeah, well, really, like, just his performance metrics are exceptional across the board. I mean, with Bucknell, I think he's one of the better Bucknell players we've seen in years. He's the third Bucknell prospect to be drafted top 10 rounds. He's performed in summer ball. He's performed in the Cape Cod League. He's performed in the Patriot League. His data in terms of his underlying hitting metrics are all pretty exceptional. He makes a lot of contact. He hits the ball hard. So really, he just checks the ball. He checks a lot of the boxes that you're looking at just from performance and results. I think Sean Keyes specifically is maybe a guy who scouts and analysts are perhaps a little bit more split on. I know there's some questions about how the swing itself works. It can be steep at times. There have been some players from these mid-major conferences who just have really loud data that scouts aren't as high on, but analysts are very high on, just because all the numbers just scream a player who performs and has performed at a number of different levels with wood bats. So he was maybe the biggest, like, if you pointed out a data darling to me in this year's draft class, Sean Keyes is probably the best example of that, just because, again, you look at everywhere he's been, he's performed, and he has great numbers. That exit velocity data is encouraging. The chase rate's encouraging. The contact rate's encouraging. He just checks a lot of boxes that some of these, like, if you're setting thresholds for contact, power, swing decisions, he would be in a group of some of the best in the class in terms of a hitter who is super well-rounded in those areas. And how he is able to perform in pro ball, I think, is going to be a big question, because there is a lot of skepticism in general from mid-major and smaller school players, because you're just not facing the same quality of competition as guys who are in the SEC or the ACC regularly. And that's why I think his Cape performance is so impressive. He did have a really strong summer in the Cape Cod League, and that is generally regarded as the best competition for college summer league. So until he stops hitting, I mean, he really has a flawless performance track record, and is a hitter that I thought he had a chance to go even higher than he did. So both with Yusavage and with a guy like Sean Keyes, I think you have players that you can find a lot to like from a scouting perspective, and just on purely in terms of value.
Sean Keyes, by the way, if you're sitting around with not a lot to do before the Jays game tonight, he got assigned to Dunedin yesterday. They have a doubleheader today starting at 5:00 nice. Eastern. So maybe Sean Keyes gets into one of these games. I wanted to look ahead with you, Carlos, a little bit because this, I don't know if you've noticed while you were doing draft and trade deadline stuff, the 2024 season has not gone great for the Toronto Blue Jays. We've fired up the tankathon at times and see how the draft looks. It's an interesting one where the Jays have the seventh to worst record in baseball, but Oakland and the White Sox, because of, you know, teams who are revenue receiving teams not being able to pick at the top of the draft so many years in a row, the Jays would currently slot fifth. Obviously there's going to be a lottery that determines the top six. We'll see if they get lucky or not. But big picture, if you were a team that was trying to contend and you dipped into the top five just for one draft, is 2025 shaping up to be a decent draft to do that in?
You know, I entered the summer with really a lot of optimism because I was tired of the 2024 class where everyone's kind of downing it. We're downplaying it. It's not a great draft class. It's really weak on the high school side. It seems like the 25 class has a chance to be solid. It does not seem like it's going to be an exceptional year like 2023. I wonder how long we're going to talk about 2023 and just reminisce on that class, because it was so excellent. I just saw the East Coast Pro Showcase, which is one of the more prominent high school showcases. So I got to see a lot of the players, at least on the eastern half of the country, last week. And there are some solid players still kind of waiting to see who the, like, standout high school players are on the hitting side. Ethan Holliday is obviously a very famous prep prospect. I think a lot of people are really excited to see him, how he's able to maintain his stock as sort of the top player in the class, one of the top players in the class. There are a few interesting bats like him. Chase LaViolette with Texas A&M is another really exciting player at the top. I think we still have some questions about this class. Like, what is the tier break? It seems like the tier break at the top might be a little smaller than this past year's class. So depending on where you're picking in the draft right now, I would feel good if you had a top two pick. I think after that, there's still a lot of work to be done to see which players are going to kind of push in that range. I would say right now, I wouldn't put anything more than just like a solid average on this class, but it's still very early. I still haven't seen all of the top players from the West Coast. There are a lot of the college players that I'm only now starting to focus on and turn my attention to. I think the Team USA 18U national team and the college national team has some intriguing players. I think the pitching side, I'm maybe more excited about some of the pitching in this class. It seems like there are more pure starters and like pitchability types with the typical first round stuff. Last year's class, we had a lot of pure stuff and maybe a lot less strikes and control. So maybe that's one area of the class that I'm intrigued with. But in terms of hitters right now, I think there's still a little bit of work to be done.
And at least still a benefit, you know, you land in the top five or whatever, you can, your bonus pool expands. You can do different things, even if, hey, this, I don't think this guy is a franchise changing guy at number five. You know, maybe you can use the extra slot money you've got there, similar to what Cleveland did in taking Bazana at number one, 1.6 mil below slot. And that lets you, you know, you still spend the money, but you're distributing it differently and structuring your draft differently than you can when you're picking 20th. Before I let you go here, Carlos, been a lot of talk, it seems, of what if baseball let teams trade their draft picks? You know, that seemed to be a bit of a talking point heading into the draft, coming out of the draft. Obviously, the earliest they could do that because of collective bargaining stuff is 2027. Your quick take on whether you'd like that as a draft guy?
Personally, I would hate it because the mock drafts would become a nightmare. But I think in general, for the draft, it would probably be a good thing. I think it would add a lot of excitement to the draft. I think it would add a lot of fun. People would have a blast hearing about a draft day trade where some team is trading up for the first round pick. And maybe there's a prominent major league prospect being moved to a competitive team. I just think it would be fun. It'd be interesting. I think really smart and savvy teams and scouting departments could really take advantage of that. I think there is maybe some sense from MLB's side that you'd kind of want to protect some of the teams who would be taken advantage of in that case. I don't think that's a really great argument against trading draft picks because teams should be free to kind of do what they want. I think teams should have as much creativity and flexibility to make moves. It's tied to the trading deadline now as well with where the draft is in the calendar. So I just think it would add a lot of chaos. It would add a lot of fun. Our hit rates on the mock drafts are not good as it is. So I can only imagine what it would look like if we're trying to project the first round and also just project trades out of thin air. I'm not really sure how the NFL and NBA guys do the mock drafts with trades, but it would become interesting specifically because baseball is not like, it's not like you are drafting for need and we could all go into the draft knowing, hey, whoever's picking two or three, they really need to get a left-handed starting pitcher. Like it's not like we can pair up need and profile like that. So it would be chaos in a lot of different ways. I think in general fans would like it. And I know that a lot of the teams who were in the draft, like, if you have different views on the talent, I think it makes sense to be able to trade up and go grab your guy. And if you're just lower on a player, trade out of that pick. I think it would be beneficial for really everyone involved except mock drafters. And as a mock drafter myself, I'm not going to hold back from everyone's fun. So I think it would be cool.
Yeah. And then, I mean, to those one or two teams that would get taken advantage of, like on the NBA side, there's the Ted Stepien rule, which because of a Cavaliers owner in the 80s kept trading away all the team's future first round picks. You're not allowed to do that anymore. You can, I don't know, let's just call it, it's the White Sox or Rockies rule. I don't know how we name it. We'll come up with a better name than that, but that's what it would be. Carlos, thanks so much for taking the time out, man.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Carlos Galazo of Baseball America. And again, their latest MLB farm system rankings are up, so you can go check those out. Our pal Jeff Ponce at Baseball America also dropped his updated Jays top 30 last week. Kylie McDaniel dropped his latest farm system rankings at ESPN as well. MLB Pipeline is updating their top 30 prospects for each team early next week. So all the dust kind of settling here post-draft, post-trade deadline, as we see guys get released, guys get signed, guys get assigned to their new locations and things like that. Busy day on the farm for the Blue Jays. Couple rainouts yesterday. So Dunedin's in a doubleheader today. Couple guys have already made their debuts there. You maybe see a couple more today, and in a doubleheader scenario, the Vancouver Canadians are in action with Yaron Watts-Brown on the hill. Double A New Hampshire's in action momentarily. The Bisons have a doubleheader after getting rained out yesterday. We talked a lot of Bisons yesterday with Joey Votto's return and Will Wagner being there. Will Wagner of the Buffalo Bisons, by the way, going to be on the show with us tomorrow, so you can look ahead to that as well. At the major league level, it's Bowden Francis against Trevor Rogers. We gave you the Trevor Rogers breakdown a little earlier. The Jays have only faced him for 10 plate appearances total. George Springer and Vlad both went 0 for against him. That was back in 2021, though. That was an entirely different pitcher. That was 3 years ago. Varsho and Brian Servin have seen him as well, but not in recent samples whatsoever. So gave you the Rogers breakdown. This Jays team is basically coming in fresh against this version of Trevor Rogers. On the Bowden Francis side, the Orioles have seen a lot of him. In fact, his last start was against the Orioles on July 29th, gave up 3 over 5 2/3. He also saw them back in early June, gave up 4 over 3 1/3. You'll be shocked to learn Ryan Mountcastle has had his number because it's Ryan Mountcastle and a Blue Jays pitcher. He is 4 for 5 against him with 2 homers and a walk. Gunnar Henderson, 2 for 3 against them, and a 718 slug overall with that Baltimore Orioles team. So we'll see. We'll see if Bowden Francis can build on the 5 2/3 innings he went back on July 29th. Not that it was a crazy, incredible start. He gave up 3 runs on 6 hits over 5 2/3. But right now in the fifth starter spot, the Blue Jays would take that every time out. We'll see if he can start, if he can continue to establish that splitter as a more useful pitch, if he can figure out the best use of that curveball other than kind of early counts to steal a strike because it's been hit very, very hard. And then, yeah, the fastball, you know, it's allowed 6 home runs. It's weirdly, like, statistically one of his best pitch despite the home run ball. But it's, ideally that's an established pitch where your breaking ball can play off of it, not the thing you're leaning on most since it's 93. We'll see how that one goes. It'll be Ben Buck and Arden on the TV side for you. We will be back tomorrow to break it down. Like I mentioned, we'll talk to Will Wagner of the Buffalo Bisons. We'll talk to Alan Doyle of Great Big C and of Alan Doyle as well. Should be a lot of fun. Thanks to Keegan Matheson, Jeff Arnold, Madison Shipman, and Carlos Collazo for joining us today. Thanks to Austin Mackey, Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass. Have a wonderful Wednesday, everyone.